every case where the gentleman was proceeding pro se, but I like to give pro se individuals an opportunity to sort of understand the way we do things. In the Court of Appeals, we're concerned with issues of law. We're not going to rehash the facts. We consider the facts, and you can rest assured that Judge Clements, Judge O'Brien, and I read your brief and understand the points that you're making in your brief. So arguing about the facts of the case is really not what we're interested in. We're more interested in legal principles.
Okay.
You'll get 15 minutes to argue your case. You can reserve any amount of time you want for rebuttal. Most people reserve 2 or 3 minutes. It's not necessary that you take all of your time. If you don't need it, you can rest assured that we understand your arguments.
Okay. Sir, I'd like to state that opposing counsel has waived their argument, their oral argument for today.
And what is your basis for saying?
The appeal is signed and then...
Can you come over to the microphone? I want to start your time.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't realize you couldn't. Would you like to see the copy of this?
No,
she's
no, tell me where in the record you believe.
It's the very last page of Ms. Jewell's appeal, her argument for appeal, and it says, counsel desires to waive oral argument.
Okay, I understand what you're saying. What that actually means is that she believes the matter could be resolved without the benefit of oral argument. Not that she's waiving it if you're going to exercise your right to have oral argument. That's what we interpret that to mean.
Understood, sir. Thank
yes,
you.
Ma'am. Thank you for bringing that to our attention.
Sure.
All right. How much time would you like to reserve for rebuttal?
4 minutes, sir, please.
Yes, ma'am. You may begin when ready.
Okay. Sir,
step over to the end.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. It's your first day being a lawyer.
Yeah. Little experience in a courtroom, but it's increasing. So in May of 2012, my husband, Dave Beatty, and I were divorced, separated. Final divorce was in 2014. We have 2 children, ages 11 and 12, Abigail and Lily. I'm here today to speak on their behalf as their advocate for what is in their best interest. I went to court with Mr. Beatty back in August to seek full legal and sole physical custody, which I already had physical custody of the girls. These girls are my babies. They're my children. They've been with me since birth. This is the most apart we've ever been. And on August 23rd, they were abruptly taken out of my home and over to their father's house and into a different environment. And we were very much torn apart. The 3 of us are very much in distress. The events that unfolded in this 2-day trial had factors of abuse of discretion throughout. I will walk you through those abuses of discretion. The first one is that within 2 to 3 hours into the trial, on day one in the morning of the trial, the circuit court stated, and I quote, "More times than not, my final decision goes against their," meaning the children, "stated preference." To me, that is a very blanketed statement to say up front and be presumptuous of how you are going to likely make your verdict without having heard the children speak or any of the other testimony. This was very early in the case. Very disturbing, and very disturbing not only for myself, but for other cases where parents have to agonize, where whether or not to put their child on the stand, and that it's basically irrelevant if what he says is true. The second factor that came up was, in the process of everything else, gun charges. My children, in about April, came home to me from a visit with their dad and mentioned to me that there were guns in the house. And I asked for the specifics. What do you mean there are guns in the house? What kind of guns? How many? Where are they? How long have they been out? And my answers were there were pistols, shotguns, semi-automatics, in the dining room, leaned against the wall, in the bedroom, leaned against the wall, and on the dining room table. Now, I believe this for 2 reasons, because I believe my children, and because this is habit of my ex-husband. We fought over the gun issue all the time. From the time our children were mobile and able to reach up onto a table and pick something up, it was a huge concern for me. Now, it's not only that my 11 and 12-year-old were exposed and had access to these guns, but my ex-husband's girlfriend has three very small boys that are two are ages three, twins, and one age five. Now, that's a very dangerous age to have a gun laying around for a child, and a boy in particular that may be especially attracted to it, to play with it. That's too much risk. It scared me to death. I went to the local station and talked to Magistrate Bowles, explained exactly what happened, wrote my report, which is in the record. Never did I mention that those guns were loaded because I didn't know if they were loaded or not. No one knew if they were loaded or not. I think that the risk is there regardless of whether you know if they're loaded or not. Maybe you think 100% that your guns aren't loaded, but guess what? It takes one. And how many gun incidents do you hear about where everyone says, I didn't know it was loaded, didn't think it was loaded? I was not willing to take that risk for my children. My thoughts were of that, of the safety of my children, over what may have happened.
Let me suggest something to
yes,
you,
sir.
Because I don't know, I wasn't at the trial, I can read the transcript and understand
yes,
what was going on, but one of the things, I was a trial judge before I was honored with the opportunity to sit on the Court of Appeals of Virginia, and part of the thing that I did oftentimes is I would listen to the way that parents of children will refer to the children, and you keep saying my children as opposed to our children. Whether you like this man or not, that's not relevant. Our concern is what's the concern of the trial court's best interest of the children. So it probably suits you better to refer to the children as our children as opposed to my children.
Yes, sir, I'll do that. Thank you, sir. Through the trial, my integrity was called into question over raising these gun charges and the fact that how did I feel about the position that it put Mr. Beatty in? Well, I felt more about the position that I was putting my children in by not saying anything. That was my first priority.
When you folks were married and lived together, former husband had weapons, guns in the house then?
He did.
And were these issues, was this an issue for you at that time?
Yes, ma'am, as I stated, we fought frequently about them. You know, more as the children were mobile and able to reach and possibly, you know, pick up one of these guns. I didn't want them around them, didn't want them handling them. For my youngest 7th and 8th birthday, he bought a gun each year for her, which she had no interest in firing or touching or doing anything with. The whole gun issue has kind of been tried to the outer perimeters of the limits of what it should be. When they're older and able to learn target shooting or if they want to hunt or whatever, that is fine, but they're little, and you know, even with these smaller little boys in the house, and they're all the children are left unattended in the house while Mr. Beatty and his girlfriend are outside smoking cigarettes and talking. So there's liberal time for them to be alone and play and be able to pick up on these guns.
Was there any instance that sort of drew your attention more with regard to the firearms as opposed to just a general concern? I understand your concern. Was there anything specific that you can refer to that caused you the greater concern?
There are several things, sir. As I said, the gun issue has been a problem from the point go. As in the last years that we were together, when we would start to have problems and fights were more frequent and stuff like that, he would bring his guns into the living room at times and be cleaning them with a cloth or whatever, and they were completely assembled. These were not disassembled guns. And he would point them directly in my direction, sometimes with the kids sitting with me in a recliner in the living room while I watch TV.
Was this brought up in the trial court?
Sir?
Was this incident brought up before the trial court?
Yes, sir. It is in a protective order from the original.
But was it brought up before Judge Tran? I guess it's a better question.
It was not, no.
If you get to the sentence, you can't stick to things that are before Judge Tran, because we cannot, as a appellate court, look at things that are outside the court.
You know, actually, I take that back. I think part of that was in the transcript for that. Yes.
Okay.
Yes, because the caseworker had been called in on that occasion.
Okay.
So that's all in the record. The third factor is that the case was tried to paint me as a person that had alienated the girls against their father. And it was stated that it started in early 2016. Now, the only thing that changed in 2016 was I got the girls their own cell phones, and I told Dave that he was welcome, gave him the numbers. You are welcome to call them on their cell phones or text them whenever you please. Open access. But please don't call my cell phone anymore. That was the change. And he had sent an email back to me and said, well, don't use my cell phone anymore. You can use my landline, which didn't have voicemail, and the ringer was always off. And I never got to talk to the girls. I got to talk to them less when they were over there than vice versa.
Did they have their cell phones?
No, they were not allowed to take the cell phones that I bought for them over to their father's house. They were without those. So I actually had less time and an opportunity to speak to them on the phone than what he had. I was giving him free access, free choice.
Did he not allow them to take them, or did he not allow them?
He did not. He would not allow. I asked him several times, and he would not allow them over there. I said, you can have the passwords to their cell phones. You can monitor what you want, because that was one of the rules when I gave them their cell phones. Do not expect privacy for your phones. We can and will go through everything. But he wouldn't allow them over there. So, you know, if anybody's trying to alienate, that I think he would be the one, actually. And the second pillar that the alienation theory was built on was this factor of summer vacation. And we had this issue every year that we had summer vacation. I had a 60% split in days of being able to see the children, and he had a 40% split, which was pretty liberal. We had choices to pick a week of summer vacation. Well, if I picked a week that wasn't one of my normal weeks, it put me over 2 weeks. There was a stipulation in the divorce decree that stated no parent is to go more than 2 weeks without seeing the children. And then right after that line, it states, if there is a conflict between the summer vacation schedule and the regular schedule, the summer vacation schedule shall control. To me, that means that beats the regular schedule. And if I go over my 2 weeks because I'm using one of my 1 week vacation schedules, it should be okay. So this was something we constantly had contention with. And I thought I was right, he thought he was right. And I said, okay, this is something we need to take back to court and just have the verbiage changed so it's not so confusing and ambiguous and, you know, left for any interpretation. But that was the other thing. But never, ever did I withhold them from him. I've always, you know, they've always, my little one in particular cries all the time when she has school there. And I have worked so hard to say, you know, oh, you know, Daisy, you guys found some more fun, you're gonna go to the beach, you're gonna go do this, you know, just to try to, I want her to be happy. The bottom line, I don't want her crying going to his house. You know, I'm here for them to be happy and settled, and they are 11 and 12 years old, which means in another year or two, they're gonna hit some pretty rough waters. They need to be with a parent who they can communicate with openly, who they trust, who they have a good, solid relationship with.
Right. We'll save the rest of your time for the follow-up.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Jules, you're getting settled in. I'll leave you through something to think about. It seems, listening to Ms. B's argument, it's a suggestion that Judge Tran, in effect, prejudge the case by saying at the outset what he said about I typically do this, or in most cases, or oftentimes, or whatever qualifying term he used to describe what he typically does. Did that cause you some concern as a practitioner to the judge before the evidence is even presented would essentially say that one side has a proof burden that they otherwise might not have.
I appreciate
the smile. Okay, now the answer, please.
I appreciate your question, Your Honor. Yes, I listened very hard to those words and for a brief moment wondered what they meant. But almost in the same breath, after the trial court intoned that verbiage, he did say that every case is fact-specific, that the court has not, quote, met these children before, that the trial court would, quote, wait to hear from these children. And the trial court also seemed to go out of its way to admonish me, as father's counsel, that it, quote, that it does not, quote, automatically take the position that is harmful for a child to come to court to tell a judge what they're thinking or how they feel. And all that another thing that comes to mind after hearing your very appropriate question is verbiage that I've read in many of this court's cases, something to the effect of this court does not take isolated statements out of context to decide if the law has been misapplied or if there's been an error in applying the law. There was not an error in applying the law here, and I want to say that the trial court spent considerable time hearing both of these children testify. Abigail, age 11 at the time, was first, followed by her sister, Lily, who was 10 at the time. The testimony of both children, I think, was 60 or 70 some odd pages of the trial transcript. It was about an hour, maybe a little bit more than an hour long, to the best of my recollection. The trial court thoughtfully questioned both children. The trial court allowed counsel to question the children. The trial court questioned the children first. These children's voices were heard. And the court stated in its ruling that it, quote, feared that the alienation being nearly complete, apparently these girls are willing to say just as their mother believes, that they should spend most of the year with their mother and the father should be reduced to the occasional visitor to be supposedly loved but not liked. And the court is convinced that if it does not change the custody order and giving the mother additional time with the daughters, the alienation not already complete or near complete will be completed, end quote. And the court said that in its ruling. The court took careful pains, as it should and as it is required to do, to go through the factors of Virginia Code 20-1.
So your argument would be that despite the trial judge's somewhat indiscreet statement at the beginning, the bottom line is that when the opportunity for the evidence to be considered was considered, the judge considered the evidence in the manner and the standard that it should have.
Absolutely. The judge examined all the factors of 20-124.3 and went through them in the judge's ruling. The court, and I think I used the words explicitly and meticulously, addressed all of these factors. The court, in addition to going through all of the 20-124.3 factors, the court expressed its, quote, grave concerns with the appellant's credibility on this and other material issues. The court made findings that since the beginning of 2016 that the appellant had engaged in a course of a pattern of conduct designed to alienate the children from their father. The court found that the appellant's taking out of a warrant, a criminal complaint against father regarding guns was baseless. The specific charge was leaving unattended, minors under the age of 14 around loaded weapons. The court found that was baseless. And the court found further that at no time has Mr. Beatty kept loaded guns around his children. And further, the court took pains to find that the children were carefully coached and prepped for the hearing by their mother. One of the witnesses at the trial was, the father's current girlfriend's ex-husband, who around the time, so the trajectory, the timeline here, is that in April of 2016, mother swore out a warrant, criminal charge about leaving, that father was exposing the children to guns and leaving them unattended around loaded weapons. And then in April, she took the eldest child to the judicial, domestic, JDR court, Juvenile Domestic Relations Court, to have that child swear out a warrant. She obtained a preliminary protective order. The preliminary protective order was dismissed, but the immediate result was that Mr. Beatty couldn't see his children for 2 weeks because of the terms of the preliminary protective order. The warrant was null prost. In the same time frame in April of 26 that Ms. Beatty took these actions, she also filed a motion to modify custody. Mr. Beatty later in May filed his own motion to modify custody. The day before Mr. Beatty filed his motion, Ms. Beatty began communicating with Mr. Beatty's current girlfriend's ex-husband. And much of the evidence that's in the record were the emails back and forth between the two, where Mother admitted that she did not know and did not care whether the guns were loaded. She said it didn't matter. And the trial court also mentioned this. The trial court also stated that it was further convinced that the evidence in this case was enough to satisfy the provisions of 20-108, which says that the intentional withholding of visitation without just cause may constitute a material change in circumstances justifying the change of custody in the discretion of the court. And the trial court went on to say that, you know, I almost don't need to get to 2124.3, but he did anyway. And I cannot emphasize enough that the court found Ms. Beatty had discussed this with their children, had discussed the testimony with both children. One of the children testified using the same language that was used in an email that Ms. Beatty had written with this man. I think the phrase was sense of home, you know, things of that nature. Further, a child's preference is not determinative in any way, shape, or form. The Court of Appeals has held that child's preference should certainly be considered and given appropriate weight. It doesn't control the custody determination, and it's just one factor to be considered. And the trial court addressed that as well. So there is no abuse of discretion here, and I cannot emphasize enough that the trial court listened to every piece of evidence in what was a two-day trial with a lot of moving pieces and witnesses, and some testimony more exciting than others, for sure. But the judge was attentive to every objection. And I want to note here, and I understand that it maybe was not as persuasive to the court because we're here today, but I do believe Ms. Beatty has fatal flaws coming before you.
Was it 518 flaws about the references in the appendix and the appendix was filed and all that?
That's correct. And there was no preservation of the issue. In fact, the discussion that Ms. Beatty is leaning on with regard to the trial court's comments occurring on the first day, approximately 2 or 3 hours into the hearing, this was after the court had heard several of the witnesses. This was after the court had heard opening arguments. This is the discussion at the time was about how to, the logistics of getting these children on the stand. Who had the children? Mr. Beatty had the children that day. They had been subpoenaed to court. And so there was a discussion on the record about logistics. Where are they? How do we get them here? The trial court was concerned with these poor children sitting outside in the hall on this awful day and made the decision that they would come on at 2 o'clock on the first day. And the statements that were made in this context. But at no time did Ms. Beatty's counsel at the time note an objection. There was no objection noted in the order from which she's appealing. In fact, the only objection was, quote, seen an objection to father being awarded sole legal custody and primary physical custody, end quote. At no time did Ms. Beatty's counsel give the court an opportunity to address this in any way, shape, or form. And I believe it's the Levy-Lee case of the Court of Appeals that says ways that you can preserve error. There are many: motions to strike, noting the objection in closing argument, a motion to reconsider, making objections and the reasons therefor clearly in the order from which you're appealing. None of that was done. I do think that that's problematic here. The opening brief doesn't refer, in contravention of Rule 5A20, to pages of the record where the error is preserved, because it wasn't. 5A20E has not been followed because there was no statement of arguments, principles of law, authorities relating to anything. And the Buchanan case says that statements unsupported by argument, authority, or citations to the record do not merit appellate consideration. Of course, the court seems well aware of my issues with the appendix, or lack thereof, and contravention of Rules 5A, 25A, and D. And given these fatal flaws, given that I don't believe there was an abuse of discretion, I respectfully ask that the trial court's decision be summarily affirmed. I did address the remand for attorney's fees, and I stand by that only because this trial was unnecessary. At the trial court level, I do believe in my heart that this appeal is unnecessary. I understand completely, based on the one comment that Ms. Beatty brought to the forefront, why the Court of Appeals is interested in hearing this. But I hope I have emphasized to you that the trial court got it right and did the right thing and went through the factors as it is bound to do by law. Thank you.
I believe Ms. Jewell stated that the judge's remarks were made after 2 p.m. after hearing Abby and Lily's testimony. That is incorrect. It was heard on the first morning before hearing anyone's testimony, including Abby and Lily's. It was made early on in the morning. I think that...
That's quite true.
I'm sorry?
She agreed.
Okay. Secondly, again, the basis for alienation and the 9 factors that he went through, he weighed heavily on the fact that he thought my gun charges brought against Dave Beatty were baseless and that it was a chance for me to get a leg up or some sort of advantage. How would you feel looking at me here today had I not filed those charges and some issue had come of it? I just feel like that's every person's right and their obligation to do that. And of my children, when they're not in my presence, there are certain things that have to be agreed upon both ways between Dave and I that ensure their safety. And the guns is one of them. And when you take and you add into the mix very little children that also have unattended access to those guns, it makes it a very dangerous scenario.
Thank you. That has been submitted. We'll come down and agree.